On this week's program, Charles Dutoit tells us about the music he's programmed for his first season as chief conductor and artistic advisor of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Our previously announced feature on Christopher O'Reilly will run next week. Jason Pfeiffer explores celebrations of the Chinese New Year in Philadelphia's Chinatown. As the Grammy-winning quintet, the Chestnut Brass Company, celebrates its 30th anniversary, we speak with founding member Jay Crush. And Susan Lewis explores the life, labor, and loves of Frida Kahlo. Kahlo-related exhibitions open in Delaware and Philadelphia this month. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Charles Dutoit will conduct his first concert as artistic leader of the Philadelphia Orchestra in September, but his artistic vision is already shaping the repertoire. Well known for his interpretations of French, Russian, and 20th century music, Dutoit marks his first season with the orchestra with a focus on the music of both Hector Berlioz and the Ballet Russe. Composers such as Stravinsky, Chopin, Debussy, Prokofiev, and Ravel all composed for the 1920s Parisian Emigre Dance Company. Dutoit will also conduct the U.S. premiere of a work by Christoph Penderecki in celebration of the composer's 75th birthday. Those making their orchestra debuts in 08-09 include the British pianist Imogen Cooper and violinist Lisa Batyashvili, and a number of young guest conductors will lead the orchestra, including the two London-based stars Vladimir Yurovsky and Yannick Nezet-Séguin. When I met with Charles Dutoit earlier this week, I first asked him if his focus on the Ballet Russe was simply a ruse to play some of his own favourite music.
Well, no, it's, you know, because, you know, there were cycles here in Philadelphia in the recent years of a lot of romantic music like Mahler, and also Christoph Eschenbach did also a cycle of Beethoven and Brahms. So, you know, I thought it would be nice to bring something a little bit different, a little bit new. And these are great scores and are very famous today, and you cannot call that modern music any longer. You know, this music was composed about 100 years ago now, and these are brilliant scores, and the orchestra, of course, excels in playing this kind of music. And we are starting this season, but we will do it over the seasons to come and try to bring back all these beautiful pieces.
Is that going to be the mark, do you think, of your 4 years, that you're going to reinforce what's come before in terms of the orchestra's traditions?
Well, yes, actually, I think one of the reasons why they asked me to come here is because I've known the orchestra at the time when it was, you know, the old Philadelphia Orchestra with these fantastic traditions of Ormandy and Stokowski still. And, when I first came here in 1980, I had heard the Philadelphia Orchestra for the first time in 1955 in Geneva, and that was a sensation, as you cannot imagine. You know, we had never heard anything like this. And I know the sound of the orchestra, and it's especially important in a transitional period as the orchestra is going through now, booking a lot of young people. Many of them come from Asia. They don't know these traditions. So if we don't keep these traditions, I think it would be too bad, because the orchestra has been so famous for representing this kind of repertoire, first of all, and the sound which comes with it also.
There is another group of young people who are becoming very prominent, and that's young conductors. A lot of orchestras around the country, and indeed around the world, now hiring conductors who are either in their 40s or younger than 40s, and some even in their 30s. When you came to prominence, and when your generation came to prominence as conductors, it was typically when you were in at least in your 50s. Do you think there's, a pattern to all of these young conductors becoming prominent? And if so, why? And is it a good thing?
Yeah, the truth is that a career today is easier than it used to be, in the sense that, you know, there are so many more concerts, so many more offers. And there is also a very big gap between the generation to which I belong and this young generation, you know, which is less the case now than it was 10 years ago. You know, during the war period, there was a big gap. So you had the old conductors and the post-war conductors. But today, it is true that there is a big door open for the youth and the dynamism and the energy and so on, and it's typical probably of our century. And they are very fortunate to do that. I only hope that they are ready to sustain a career like this, because it's very nice to be booked when you are 25 or 29, but you know, you also have to stay 10 years in charge of an orchestra, and that's a lot of work. Believe me, you know, the repertoire, because when I was young, I also had the chance to work very soon with the big things. But my problem was to build the repertoire, and I had to do so many new pieces with the well-known orchestras, and somehow I found it extremely difficult. So I just withdrew from that and took the time to build my personality with other things, not only music and career and hotels and big cars and big planes, but to have what I would call the typical European approach of humanistic studies, and to try to bring things together, which I think is extremely important for a musician. I don't like specialization, and a musician is not just waving in front of an orchestra. Yes, and a conductor has to build his own general culture and knowledge of, what's going on, because you cannot just touch the music if you don't know where it comes from in terms of when it was composed and what kind of society in which these composers were working. For instance, Beethoven would not be Beethoven had he lived 20 years before, or 30 years later. The bridge of the, 18th to 19th century after the French Revolution, that was the society of the time, and he just grabbed these things in the name of freedom and did what he did and became what he became, So it's important to know all these things, and I just wish that all the young people will never forget that.
What is it that encourages you to look at a young conductor and to say he's ready for the Philadelphia Orchestra?
Well, I think we have to give them a chance. Actually, I'm not here to judge myself. The orchestra will need to bring these young people for the years to come, so it's better to try them first, you see, and the musicians and the board and all the people and myself, if I'm here, will judge whether they deserve to conduct such an orchestra or not, and then the result will be either they come back or they don't, you see, and that's how it is.
I want to finally just turn to Hector Berlioz. You're conducting many of his works in the forthcoming season. Why was the time right now for Hector Berlioz to have such a starring role with the Philadelphia Orchestra?
Well, it's because he's probably a composer which has been a little bit neglected here. I mean, the one has played a lot, the Symphonie Fantastique, and a few things, a few overtures here and there. But there are some major pieces which have been played very rarely. For instance, the Requiem, no one remembers when it was played last time. And Romeo and Juliet was last played with Muti, so it's already more 20 years ago. I think Berlioz is a very important composer in the history of music. When he composed the Symphonie Fantastique, he was 26, and Beethoven had just died, And he invented the symphonic poem. One always says it's Liszt, but actually the first piece written on a text which he wrote himself with this incredible young romantic imagination, the text of and the Symphonie Fantastique, which is a little bit of, autobiography, mm-hmm. You see? And then also what he did in terms of instrumental discoveries.
Considering he only played guitar.
Yeah, he actually played only guitar. That is really something. But imagine somebody who was studying in another field, medical thing. He wanted to become a composer, and he's an incredible man at 26 to be able to, out of the blue, write a piece like the Symphonie Fantastique. There is very little example in the history of such a genius, early genius, without preparation. As you said, for a guitar player, it's not bad.
Charles Dutoit. He's in town for the coming weeks to guest conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra. His tenure at the helm of the orchestra begins in September.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
February 7th marked the beginning of the Chinese New Year, which annually coincides with the first new moon of the solar calendar. This Lunar New Year is not just observed by those of Chinese heritage, it's also celebrated by many of East Asian descent around the world. And the festivities extend far beyond the first day of the Chinese New Year. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the traditional Chinese New Year celebration takes on a vibrant life in Philadelphia and goes on for several weeks.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. In Chinese, what we say? Now say this after me. 新年好.
Artist Yu Yang is a retired arts administrator who often leads children's craft workshops, teaching kids about Chinese culture and art. Yang emigrated to Philadelphia from Beijing more than 20 years ago. Last Friday, the second day of the Chinese New Year, she visited the Independence Branch Library in Philadelphia to lead a session with dozens of children, teaching them about the Chinese New Year and showing them how to make Chinese paper cuttings and other traditional handcrafts.
Look at this!
with a diverse mix of children on hand. Yu Yang explained that this is the year of the mouse, as she prefers to call it. It's more commonly called the year of the rat. The rat is the first of the 12 animal zodiac cycle. Yang says like mice or rats, those born in rodent years are said to be intelligent and cunning.
It is said that your personality, your career success, whatever, will more or less like that animal. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I partially believe it.
Yang says the Chinese New Year, or the Spring Festival, is the most important holiday in Chinese culture. It's like Christmas and the January 1st New Year's Day for Westerners. Preparations, including cleaning and decorating the home, can begin as early as 2 weeks beforehand. The arrival of the New Year, which falls between January 21st and February 20th, is marked by large gatherings and visits among relatives and friends. The Spring Festival celebration continues for at least 14 days, but the biggest event is the New Year's Eve reunion dinner that family members share together. The meal traditionally includes fish, symbolic of the hope for surplus in the New Year. The arrival of the New Year also includes the distribution of red envelopes or packets containing money in even denominations, which reflect good luck and prosperity for the New Year. The Philadelphia region is home to thousands of Chinese Americans. Immigrants came from China to the city as early as 1845. Today, the hub of Chinese culture in the Delaware Valley is Philadelphia's Chinatown, located in the heart of Center City. The towering, ornate Friendship Gate at 10th and Arch Streets marks the entrance to a neighborhood lined with shops, restaurants, and other businesses. Each year, during the New Year celebration, lion dance parades take place in Chinatown. The lion dance is a form of traditional dance in Chinese culture, in which performers mimic a lion in a lion costume. Last Sunday afternoon, the lion dance troupe led by Harry Leong took to the streets and performed in front of stores throughout Chinatown, the streets packed with hundreds of onlookers. Leong, president of the Philadelphia Suns, a Chinatown youth organization that organizes recreational events and community service, explains how music accompanies the procession of performers that weave their way through the streets.
You have the drummer, you have the gong player, and you have the cymbals. And you can have two cymbals, three cymbals, you've got 10 cymbals, whatever. Or you can have a number of lines. There's two people in each line. One is in the head, and one is in the tail.
Leong says the movement of each lion is not random. There are very specific stances and head movements that require training and practice. He says Chinese lion dance is something he grew up doing.
As young as I remember, 8 years old, we went to kung fu school and lion dance school, and so we learned the art at that young age. And then as I grew, learning and performing each year in the streets, we ended up passing that tradition down to the other kids.
Leong views performance of the lion dance as a way for the Philadelphia Suns to share Chinese culture with the surrounding community. But he says the energy on the streets and the fireworks that are set off all throughout the neighborhood during the lion dances makes involvement enticing.
It really pumps you up. I mean, you see these big M80 type things, and when they go boom, I mean, you really feel it. And when you go through a long, 100-foot long firecracker, and you hear the crowd cheering, you know, and it's a fun thing.
Leong notes that the Philadelphia Suns troupe is not the only group that performs the lion dance in Chinatown. Other teams will also parade in the neighborhood during the Spring Festival. The Chinese New Year celebration comes to a close next Thursday with the Lantern Festival, a day when colorful lanterns are traditionally hung in the streets and people eat glutinous rice balls with fillings like chocolate and dried fruit. But with 6 days left in the two-week festival, the Chinese New Year celebration in Philadelphia and around the world is still far from over.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Chinese New Year celebrations continue this afternoon at the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia until 4, with craft activities, cultural demonstrations, and Chinese dance and vocal performances. Also, tomorrow at noon and next Sunday at noon, there'll again be lion dances and parades in Philadelphia's Chinatown. The Chestnut Brass Company is a brass quintet that has grown over its 30-plus years from a Philadelphia City street band to an internationally renowned ensemble. With a varied repertoire that ranges from Baroque to contemporary music, The group is also distinctive for its use of ancient and antique brass instruments such as cornetti, sackbuts, keyed bugles and sax horns. I recently caught up with one of the founders of the Chestnut Brass Company, Jay Crush. So 30 years ago, this group of musicians got together and didn't play as they would do in later decades in wonderful concert halls, but on the street in Philadelphia.
That's true. It was an abandoned storefront at 17th and Chestnut Street, hence the name the Chestnut Brass Company. It's where Liberty Place now stands. We always like to think of it as a monument.
To the beginnings of this group.
Yes.
And how did you all know each other?
Actually, some of us didn't know each other. There were a couple people who just asked for references. They were interested in putting together a group to busk, that's play on the street with the case out. And somebody I didn't know called me and said, would you like to come play 4 hours a day out on the street in Philadelphia? And it was a nice sunny day. And I just thought, oh, sure, why not? And we played together for that whole summer, and that's how the group got started.
Brass is very evocative. Even if you have no knowledge or interest in classical music, hearing brass played on the street, I would guess, would attract a lot of attention. Because we have these associations with school bands, military bands, all of the things that people who perhaps who never step inside a concert hall would find a connection with.
Right. Brasses have always been part of the public music. Things that were needed when you needed to be heard long distances. They started out as signaling devices. They weren't even originally used as instruments way, way back. A lot of the music that we play comes from the origins of the group, but we use historical instruments as well as modern ones. And in the 19th century, brass instruments were the loudest instruments there were.
Tell me about how you're selecting repertoire.
Our group basically likes to do as many different things as we can possibly manage. So we cover a wide range of period music from Renaissance, Baroque, and different eras of the 19th century. And everybody keeps their feelers out for composers that interest them. We bring up the names, and then, of course, there's the issue of finding commissioning funds and so forth. We'll be playing 4 commissioned, either whole or parts of works on our program on the 18th. A large work by Jan Krzyzewski, teaches here at Temple University. One by Lois Vierk, a composer from New York, some pieces of one by Peter Schickley, and finally one by Jennifer Higdon, another Philadelphian.
What, to your mind, as a composer, are the limitations of brass, if there are any?
There are less limitations than one would think. I'm a tuba player, and tuba players have gotten very militant about sticking up for what their instruments can do. There are certain endurance issues that you encounter that you might not encounter with the piano or string instruments. You do have to have some time where you take the mouthpiece off of your face. There are little muscles that do get fatigued. So that, for example, you couldn't do a brass version of one of the Morton Feldman 4-hour string quartets. There's a limit there.
Over the last 30 years, from those humble beginnings on Chestnut Street, the group has garnered a multinational or an international reputation, and you've played around the country and around the world. Tell us a little bit about touring.
For a long time, when we started touring throughout the United States, it was all done by van. So we've seen every corner of the continental United States that you would never get to see if you were flying. And we have some really
memorable... And everywhere in between as well.
Absolutely, some memorable. We spent one night on the floor of a Wildcat oil driller's house in Colorado when our van broke down. And we've seen a lot of unusual places. Now we mostly fly. We're getting out of the U.S. a little bit more. We're going to Asia this summer. We have a lot of equipment to bring with us. And obviously, we usually play about 30 instruments in a concert, a lot of which are pretty much irreplaceable. And it's definitely more stressful to fly than it used to be, more expensive, more difficult.
And more difficult to get instruments into the cabin as well. I imagine impossible if you're carrying 30 instruments with you.
Most of them go in big, carefully designed flight trunks with individual foam containers. And we've been very fortunate so far. Everything has survived intact.
What's next for the Chestnut Brass Company, 30 years in? Was this the way you thought it was going to pan out? And if not, how long did you think it was going to be? Did you think 30 years ago that you'd be doing a 30th anniversary concert?
When we first started, we didn't give any thought to the future at all. Even when we started experimenting with early instruments, we were just doing it because we were curious and it was fun. I am delighted that we've gotten through 30 years. Some things are different than I would have expected that they would be, but generally I think we're happy with where we are, and we're hoping to keep the group together and keep touring and performing until we just physically can't do it anymore.
Jay Crush. The Chestnut Brass Company will present its 30th anniversary concert on Monday at the Ethical Society Building on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. Last year, the Mexican artist Frida Kahlo would have been 100 years old, and the anniversary spurred renewed consideration of her work. The Philadelphia Museum of Art opens its Frida Kahlo exhibition next week, but there's also a more intimate companion show now in progress at the Delaware Art Museum. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to the Wilmington show, which considers Frida the artist and the woman through the work of another artist who knew her well.
Frida Kahlo, through the eyes of Nicolas Morai, is more than a look at the colorful Mexican painter, known for her bold colors, dramatic symbolism, and many self-portraits. It's more than a display of the work of a gifted photographer, because Frida Kahlo was, to Nicolas Morai, more than a subject for his camera.
Nicolas Morai really wanted to marry Frida Kahlo.
Mary Holohan, curator of collections and exhibitions at the Delaware Art Museum, says while in the history of art, the idea of a favorite subject is not new.
But I think in modern times, when we've lost a little bit the romantic idea of the artist and muse, which certainly Kahlo could be considered for Nicolas Morai, in that sense it's a little bit unusual.
A muse and more to Morai. Frida was also a powerful personality and an artist in her own right, although she was not, in the 1930s, the big star she is today. The daughter of a Mexican mother and German-born father, politically, Frida embraced the Mexican nationalist movement. She also suffered with lifelong injuries from a childhood bout with polio and a trolley car accident in her teens, which left her in pain and in need of multiple surgeries throughout her life. After the accident, she had turned to painting. Her works were intensely personal, says Holohan, dominated by her preoccupations.
Many of which she named pain, death, the importance of the emerging indigenous Mexican identity.
Of the approximately 200 paintings Frida did over the course of her life, 66 were self-portraits. When she was 22, she married renowned muralist Diego Rivera, who encouraged her work yet overshadowed her talent.
On the formal art scene, she was known primarily as being Diego Rivera's wife, as doing sort of interesting and eccentric painting.
On the other hand, Nicolas Morai was well known from his celebrity photographs in Harper's Bazaar and Vanity Fair. His artistry is now evident to Danielle Rice, executive director of the Delaware Art Museum, who initially had her concerns about a show of this sort.
My big surprise was how incredibly powerful and very compelling these images are, both as images of Kahlo, but also as works of art in and of themselves.
The Hungarian-born Morai had come to New York City in 1913, around the time of the now-historic Armory Show. He joined an arts community that included artists from Europe as well as Mexico. In 1931, on a trip to Mexico to visit the home of his friend, celebrity caricaturist Miguel Covarrubias, Morai met the 24-year-old Frida Kahlo. Frida became Morai's favorite subject. Love letters attest to the nature of their relationship, the intensity of which increased after Frida separated from Rivera, whom she divorced in 1939.
During the separation, he really was convinced that they would marry. Eventually, when Kahlo and Rivera remarried, Morai realized that this was not going to be the future. The photographs begin to dwindle off, and they occur more so when she was coming to New York to show her work, or sometimes when she came to New York for medical treatment.
However successful Morai was, he wasn't making money off Frida. Most of the photographs in this show, like most of those he took of Frida, were never made public during her lifetime. Some were discovered only in 1993 by Morai's son and daughter in an attic trunk. The images have an intimacy about them. They shed light on not just one artist, says Courtney Waring, director of education at the Delaware Art Museum.
What's really exciting is that we have an opportunity in our programs to share with our visitors two different artists. We can celebrate Nicolas Morai as a photographer, but also celebrate Frida Kahlo and the Mexican heritage that she is showing us in these portraits of her.
The show includes about 50 photographs taken mostly between 1937 and 1941. Arranged chronologically, the photographs include early candids taken of Frida with her family and friends, and a large number of more studied portraits. In many of these, Frida is posed, but in her natural habitat, holding a stuffed eagle, petting a live deer. In one shot, Frida, decked out in brilliant pink traditional Mexican garb, leans against the bright blue wall of her house, wearing distinctive dangle earrings in the shape of human hands, a gift from Picasso, who, along with artists like surrealist André Breton, had praised her work. Mary Holohan says, aside from their revealing insights about Kahlo, the photographs show that Morai was a master of his art.
The way he makes colors work together, he had, with Kahlo, I think, a sort of fertile field to work with, both in the compositional and color sense, and also on the emotional level. She was used to conquering physical pain. She also had a lot of psychological pain, primarily because of her relationship with Rivera, who publicly made it known many times that he was not a faithful husband, that he was virtually impossible to get along with.
Frida Kahlo created a persona for herself, on the canvas and in her private and public life. She appears most often dressed in traditional Mexican costume, and her expression is alternately stoic, defiant, pensive, or wistful. In some, she even shows the trace of a smile. Four of the photographs in the show are of finished Kahlo paintings. There are also several of Frida at work, or at least posed beside her work. In one, Frida sits, paintbrush in hand, next to a life-sized double self-portrait in progress, the two Fridas. On the canvas are what Kahlo herself described as the happy Frida next to an unhappy Frida. The photograph adds a third Frida, whose expression is, as ever, mysterious. The exhibition itself, along with an upcoming show of Colombian-born artist Fernando Botera, has been a vehicle, says Executive Director Danielle Rice, for the Art Museum to connect with Wilmington's Latinos.
We invited leaders in the Latin American community to come to the museum to hear about the exhibitions and to brainstorm with us on ways that we could be a good community resource to different Latin American groups.
Frida Kahlo died at the age of 47 in 1954. Since her death, her popularity has soared. Among other tributes, she's been the subject of numerous exhibitions, musicals, and a Hollywood film. This exhibition tells a number of smaller stories, of Frida Kahlo, the young woman painter, of Nicolas Morai, the captivated photographer, and of a relationship that endured to the end of her life. The show is also a spark for stories to come, about celebration of cultural identity and the power of art to bring people together, something that would have, perhaps, made Frida smile.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Frida Kahlo, through the eyes of Nicolas Morai, runs through March 30th at the Delaware Art Museum. The Frida Kahlo exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art opens on Wednesday and runs through May 18th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Catherine Blodgett, Dennis Lawson, Margaret Bernardi and John Chin. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.